And I need to start this with a story. The story goes like this. Years ago, I was at a presentation at Southern Methodist University on memory, and the key speaker was John Dominic Crossan, who happened to be one of the co-chairs of the Jesus Seminar. He got up and gave a presentation on memory, and I've been in numerous settings with him where we are on the opposite sides of the conversation in the dialogue about Jesus. And in this particular setting, he came and brought a thing on memory. And here's how his thing on memory went. The apostles may be eyewitnesses. They may have experienced the events that Jesus experienced, but that doesn't nail down the trustworthiness of the Gospels because memory is faulty. So they could have been an eyewitness, they could have seen it, they could have talked about it, but their memory about what is said, we know that memory is faulty, so being an eyewitness is no guarantee. Now, those of you who've been around the church any length of time know that when we talk about the Gospels and their apostolic roots, the idea that these are eyewitnesses and their memory is important is huge in the conversation about the Gospels. So that's an important challenge. Here's how he illustrated it, and this is the story. He illustrated it with a psychological study on memory done at the University of Emory, and out of the psychology department. And the story involved the Challenger disaster. Remember the Challenger disaster? That's the space shuttle that went up and exploded with the school teacher as one of the astronauts. Okay, so here's what they did at Emory. When that happened, they called together a group of freshmen and said, "Where were you when the Challenger exploded, and how did you hear about it?" Okay, so they're testing their memory about a traumatic event. That's the premise. Okay, and so they recorded it and sent them on their way. 3 years later, they came back, assuming they'd be seniors, probably a bad assumption. Anyway, 3 years later, they came back, assuming that they were seniors, and asked them the same set of questions. And they got a new set of answers. 3 years down the road, okay, the question was, does memory leak? Okay? Then what they did is they compared the two sets, they brought them back together after a little bit of time, they brought them back together and they said, here are the two sets of answers that you gave us. One time you answered this, and one time you answered this. And they didn't match. Particularly important for the cases where it didn't match. And what they showed is that in many cases, it was the more recent memory and not the original memory back to the event that the person recalled. Okay? And so Crossan presented this and said, see, they can be eyewitnesses, but memory's faulty. Memory messes up. By the way, you can ask any lawyer about this, and they'll tell you for a variety of reasons that often is the case, that you don't always get the exact same recollections by a variety of people on the same scene for a variety of reasons, and in some cases, because people do remember poorly. And there are a series of other studies that have done this. So I had the rebuttal at this presentation. And I didn't know he was going to say this beforehand, so I'm responding literally off the cuff. And I get up and I say, it's a very interesting study, and I think it's significant, but there are a couple of things that give me pause about how much to draw from this study. First of all, the students at Emory had no stake in the event that is being described. Okay? They're simply American citizens who may support the space program, and may respect the space program, but they have no stake in what is being remembered. So I said, I wonder what the results would be if you took astronauts in the NASA program who will have to climb in a space shuttle yet to be launched, okay? And you tested their memory of this event. I said, I'm deeply suspicious the results would be different. Now, in fact, there have been tests run about memory in cases where people have something at stake in the memory, okay? And they do generally tend to show that memory does better when that's the situation. And I've learned that since then, okay? But it's not perfect. Memory does leak, okay? But you do better when there's something at stake. And so I said, the situation that we have with the apostles is that they have something at stake in what it is that they are recalling, because they are being persecuted, and in some cases they are dying for what they believe in. And so this isn't just a random association of something that they like to have an association with. There's something at stake in what they're doing. So I questioned it at that point. The second point that I would make is that you're dealing with what I would call individual memory. Okay? Each person is being tested individually for their memory of their own experience. And that's not the same as corporate memory. Corporate memory is when many people are asked to reflect on the same event. Okay? And their reflections are pooled, if you will. Now, in fact, we do this all the time. Okay? We do this all the time. If you think about situations in which corporate memory works on an oral basis, okay, the best example I can think of is when someone dies in someone's family. And people get together, you know, they're gathering before the funeral, or as they're leading up to the funeral, or they're just going to visit the family. And what happens? People come into the room and they begin to share. And what do they share? They share their memories of what they remember about that person in their life and how they impacted them. That often happens in those situations and scenes. And what sometimes happens in those situations and scenes is one person will tell a story and another person will tell a story and say, yeah, I was there too, and this is also what happened. And you get different memories and you pool the results, okay, out of what's going on. Or as I like to say it, saying it another way, if you ask my wife about our courtship, and you ask me about our courtship and what we remember about it, we remember distinct things. Okay? We don't remember exactly the same thing. And to get a sense of what our courtship was really like, it probably is a good idea to pool our memories and to not let each of us speak individually about it. What you have in the church with regard to Jesus is a pooled corporate memory as opposed to individualized memory. And pooled corporate memory can exercise a check on what is being remembered because you have more than one person working over the discussion of the event. So here's what I'm saying, is that corporate memory and memory with something at stake are what is going on in the early church. And these two elements enhance the potential for careful memory. By the way, I forgot to tell you a story about orality that I don't want to forget to pass on. So put this discussion on hold, because I'm going to forget this if I don't do it now. And go back to the orality discussion. You know who teaches me a lot about orality? My grandkids. Okay, let me explain this to you. My grandkids, until about the age of 5, live in a world of orality. They can't read or they can't write, but they know stories. Okay? They can pass on to me details about Star Wars, okay, and dialogue in Star Wars, okay, that I don't recall, because I don't care about it. Okay? I mean, it's a great story, but I don't care about Star Wars. But my little grandsons, who are now 8 and 6, but back when they were 5 and 3, okay, they could tell you what's happening in the story. Why? Because here's another important point. They heard the story over and over again until they got it. Or let me tell you a story about my daughter when she was little, my oldest daughter. I used to read books to her, Bible story books to her, when she was a kid and she would go to bed. And they were these little Bible stories that were put out by Concordia Press, a Lutheran press, and they were done in rhyme. And her favorite one was of Nicodemus. And I would read the story to her, and I can be an ornery dad sometimes. And so sometimes I would read the story to her, and I would change the rhyme. I would change the line. And you know what she inevitably would say to me, because she knew the story well? Daddy, that's not how it goes. And then she would tell me, and she'd be upset with me messing with the story. And then she would tell me what the line was. She would correct me. Almost inevitably, always right. Okay? Because she knew the story. She cared about the story. She remembered the story. She passed on the story. So I'll tell you who taught me about orality. The people who taught me most about orality were my kids and my grandkids. Okay? And I'm sure you've experienced this if you do storytelling with your kids as well. If you mess up with the story, that's not how it goes. Okay? And you get a theological rebuke. Okay? So that's orality, if you want to think about it. And memory, corporate memory, memory with something at stake, that adds to the care with which things are done, particularly when you come along and you assign people with the responsibility, apostles, you assign people the responsibility to keep an eye out for the way the story and the tradition is circulating. That's what I think we had going on in the early church. That's why you appoint someone to be an apostle who knew Jesus from the beginning. And so all these elements feed in to what we get before we even write a word about Jesus on a page that goes into a gospel. Okay, I'm done with that idea. Let me stop and see if there are any questions about that before I move on to the next thing. Any comments or questions about any of that, morality, memory, etc.? Yes. Yeah, some of the core facts. That terrific observation. Some of the core facts. You're exactly right. And another thing I like to say when it comes to the Gospels is, you know, the debate that we get into in the Gospels is usually about details. Okay? But think about this. Step back and think about this. Do you think the apostles got the story right on whether Jesus presented himself as one among many prophets or as uniquely the Christ? Do you think they would have gotten that core part of the story right? Okay, that doesn't require a memory of detail. Okay, that requires a memory of the hub of the issue. Okay, so it's a very, very good point. Yes, everyone's assuming that the one thing that we do remember correctly is the Challenger blew up, and probably also, not only did it blow up, but it wasn't just the normal astronauts who died. Part of what made that so tragic was the fact that the one time that the space shuttle decides to blow up is a time when not everyone who's a professional astronaut is on the ride. Good point. Good point. Okay? All right. Let's move on to the next issue, and let me see if I can get the slide here to move on. Now, again, I'm still setting up things related to where we're going with the Gospels before we get to the Gospels. And let's talk about authorship. Another book by Bart Ehrman, who is becoming the poster boy for the seminar. Okay. Another thing about Bart Ehrman is that he's argued in a book called Forged that the authors claim to be associated with given books are not necessarily the authors who wrote those books. In fact, in the case of the four Gospels, he says, we don't know that Matthew wrote Matthew, we don't know that Mark wrote Mark, we don't know that Luke wrote Luke, we don't know that John wrote John. In fact, we don't know who any of those authors are. And he suggests for certainly many of the Pauline epistles, we don't know that those epistles went back to Paul. In the case of 1 Peter, I did a two-hour debate with him on British radio 2 years ago on whether or not Peter could write 1 and 2 Peter. So he doubts the authors wrote the books that are tied to them by tradition, by what the church has said about who the authors are. I just want to use one example. Here's the claim that goes with that theory, because, again, another way to think about doing this is there's what the church is taught to believe, and then there's what the alternative theory is. Sometimes it's of value to look to see if the alternative theory holds water. That's what I'm going to do with authorship here. I'm going to do it with the Gospel of Mark. Okay? It's one example. In the case of Mark, the argument is, and this is the general argument, we don't know who the author is. So what the early church did is they picked someone who was a luminary, someone who was famous in the church, attached their name to the Gospel because they didn't know who the Gospel was authored by. It was anonymous and they didn't know who it was. And by doing that, they lift up the status of the Gospel in question and present it to the church as authoritative because of the name with which it is associated, either an apostle or an apostolic associate. Okay? That's the argument of the alternative view, is that the church didn't know who the authors were, they picked the name of someone, respected it, attached it to the book, and that way the book achieves its respect. Okay? You got what the alternative view is? Okay, now let's look at this in the case of Mark. In the case of Mark, the argument is that Mark gives this credibility to this gospel. Now let's look and see what we know about Mark. Here's what we know about Mark from the New Testament. Okay? We know fundamentally two things about him. Maybe three. One thing that we know is he did belong to a prominent family in Judea in Acts is seen as hosting the early church community in certain settings. Okay, that we know about. Here's the other two things we know about. Went home to mama in the midst of the first missionary journey because he couldn't stand up to the persecution. Second thing that is on his resume, his CV, is that he caused a split between Barnabas and Paul before the second missionary journey. That's what we know about Mark, okay? Part of a prominent family, okay, that part I get. But his two acts that we know about are both negative. Didn't make it through the persecution of the first missionary journey, caused a split between Paul and Barnabas before the second missionary journey, so much so that Paul went and did his thing in the second missionary journey, and Barnabas went off and did his own thing in mission. Okay? So that's not a stellar CV by which to be the endorsement behind the gospel. Now, it's even worse than this. Because in the early church tradition that Eusebius tells us comes from Papias, remember I told you Papias goes back to the early part of the second century. Eusebius tells us that what Papias said is that Mark got his gospel from Peter. Okay? That he is rendering traditions and passing on traditions that Peter taught. Now think about this. If that's the case, and the church knows it, or the church suspects it, just that much, the church suspects that's the relationship, then why isn't the Gospel of Mark called the Gospel of Peter? Put Peter's resume up against Mark, and you can choose between Mark and Peter. Okay, Mark, you know, the one who didn't get through the first missionary journey, Mark, the one who caused the split between Saul and Barnabas, or Peter. Okay, now his resume rings. Okay, he's at the top of the 12. He gives the speech at Pentecost. He's the one through whom God brings the gospel to Cornelius. I mean, if you go on the list, you know, he's winning an ESPY. Okay, all right, he's getting awards. And you have the choice to fill in a blank, an X, because you don't know. And you have the choice between Mark and Peter. And the tradition is even allowing you to make that choice. And if the issue is giving stature to a book and you have freedom to make the choice, then why isn't the Gospel of Mark called the Gospel of Peter? And it isn't. The consistent testimony of the early churches is the Gospel of Mark. And my explanation for that, I think the only explanation for that is because the church knows who the author is, and they aren't playing fast and loose with authorship. Because if they could have played fast and loose with authorship, even on an associative basis, I mean, they had every reason in the world to be able to do it, they could have called the Gospel of Mark the Gospel of Peter, and then it would have come with a stellar recommendation from the very beginning. See what I'm saying? Yeah. I think that example shows the vacuous nature of the theory. Because it doesn't work in a case where we have several variables that we can test. Okay? So my suspicion is that the early church tradition knows stuff. I've already suggested to you, we live in an oral culture. Part of our problem, I think, in assessing the tradition of the early church is we don't live in a world of orality. We don't know how, we aren't familiar with how it works and how it can be careful. So we can imagine in our heads all kinds of ways it can go awry. But I think, you know, we do know that in the early church there was a lot of communication going back and forth between the churches. They talked to each other. We see that in the letters that they write, so much so that one British writer years ago wrote an article called The Holy Internet. And it was a discussion about how the early churches communicated with one another. And he used the analogy of the internet to make the point, because he says, they're circulating letters to one another. When a letter is read in one church, they're sending it on to the other church, etc. They're back and forth. They know what's happening with one another's ministries. Surely they know. He's writing these works and where they came from. So, that's authorship. Let me put one other on the table before we turn to events, and that's the topic of miracles. The topic of miracles. Now, another thing that you often hear with regard to miracles in the ancient world is miracle workers were a dime a dozen. There are lots of them. Jesus isn't that exceptional. in being a miracle worker. It is true that there are lots of stories about miracle workers in the ancient world. Most of the stories about miracle workers in the ancient world have them working one or two miracles. Okay? They don't have a body of work that's miraculous. There are some exceptions to this, but for the most part, one or two. So, for example, you sometimes hear, oh, the Roman emperors are attributed with doing miracles in their lifetime. It's true, Vespasian, who actually lived after Jesus, is attributed to have done two miracles, to have healed a lame person and a blind person in Alexandria of Egypt at one point. That's attributed to him. Two miracles. And that's all the authentication he needs to be an emperor. Okay? Two. You have the example of Julius Caesar, whose miracle is said to have been riding a boat through a storm and surviving. If you actually read that story carefully, he doesn't calm the winds. Okay? His belief is that the gods will protect him and his troops as he rides over the storm. There's no miracle there at all other than survival, the fact of survival. There's no appeal, there's no calming of the storm, or whatever. Sometimes the angels in the details. And so you want to pause and think about what you're hearing. Now, there are other examples. A very famous one coming out of Judaism is Homi the Circle Drawer. Okay, I love these names. The two great miracle workers associated with the first century of Judaism are called Homi the Circle Drawer and Hanina ben Doza. Okay, you know. Be glad Judaism didn't become the religion of the world and you're naming your kids Hanina. Okay, anyway. So you've got Homi the Circle Drawer. Okay, Homi the Circle Drawer's claim to miraculous fame is that during a drought, he drew a circle around himself. He was known as a prayer warrior. He drew a circle around himself and he said, I'm standing here until you make it rain, God. God, make it rain. Actually, Homi the Circle Drawer is not a miracle worker. He is a prayer warrior. Okay? His prayer causes God to act and he's seen as someone who engages in effective prayer. He's not really a miracle worker in the technical sense of the term. Okay, that's it. The big example that's often brought forward is Apollonius of Tyana. He's the Greco-Roman example. There was a biography written about him that was written, now get this in light of the discussion we just had, it was written in the latter part of the second century, and he's a first century figure. So the gap that we're talking about between event and writing, remember I told you that in the Gospels it's about 30 to 50 years? The gap that we're talking about for him is a full 100 plus years. That's the first thing to know. Second thing to note is that the biography that was written about him was commissioned by a wife of an emperor who was anti-Christian. That already is suspicious. Are we getting a story tied to Apollonius that gives him a portrayal of being a miracle worker, a la, and in contrast to Jesus, but on the pagan side, in support of pagan concerns? Many people working with the work that's tied to Apollonius think that is very much likely to be the case. There's also a great deal of suspicion about some of the sources that go into Apollonius's discussion as well. Interesting thing is, one of the miracles that Apollonius is alleged to have done is raising someone from the dead. If you actually read the text where this is described, the author in an aside says that he thinks Apollonius was aware that the person was really not dead. So it's not really a resurrection from the dead. It only appeared to be. So that's interesting. So there are a lot of interesting things that go on with some of these stories and the way we talk about miracle workers being a dime a dozen in the ancient world. But there's one other feature that's very, very important. And that is to analyze the miracle accounts that we do have and the way in which they are presented. And someone did this from a sociological angle in studying the Jewish context of the miracles and the tradition out of which Jesus comes. So it was an Oxford University dissertation written a few years ago by a fellow named Eric Eadie, E-D-E, is his last name. It's called The Jewish Context of Jesus' Miracles. In it, he cited a German writer who sociologically classify the kinds of miracles that you see in Second Temple Judaism that are attributed to figures and the kinds of miracles that are attributed to Jesus. And he used abbreviations to summarize this. So when you look at this slide, you go, what in the world is MNP, BNP, PNP, and BNP? And you go, that makes no sense. You're right. Okay? Because no seminar is worth its money unless I give you something in code that I have to decode, and now you're in on the secret. Okay? So this is the secret part of the seminar. All right? So here we go. MNP means mediator of numinous power. Mediator of numinous power. Or another way to say it is mediator of transcendent power. The miracle worker in question, okay, uses a formula or some type of object or something like that to invoke God or the gods to act. So you take clay and you put it in someone's eyes. Or you say abracadabra or some type of formula to invoke the gods. You find some mystery phrase that invokes the gods. Okay? That person is a mediator of numinous power, a mediator of transcendent power. Okay? He's using an object to awaken the god of the gods to act. It's actually God who performs the miracle, or the gods who perform the miracle. Okay? But there's some object that is designed to awaken the deity to act. That's MNP. Okay? You can see where this is going. PNP, petitioner of numinous power. Petitioner of numinous power. That's Honi the circle drawer. Okay? Honi prays for God to end the drought. Honi doesn't end the drought. God does. God makes it rain. Okay? That's petitioner of numinous power. Elijah, when he ends the drought in the Old Testament, he's a petitioner of numinous power. He is a prayer warrior. His prayer invokes God to act. God does the miracle. Okay? Now the last one. This is the big category. Bearer of numinous power. Bearer of numinous power. Bearer of transcendent power. Here, there's no appeal to another figure to act. Here, the figure acts directly out of his own power. Okay? See the difference between that one and the first two? It's important. Because here's the observation that E.B. made. The bulk of Jesus' miracles portray him as a BNP, as a bearer of numinous power. He acts directly. He doesn't pray and ask God to act. He says to the man with the withered hand, stretch out your hand. He doesn't appeal to God to calm the storm. He's the one who calms the storm. Okay? So he is a direct bearer of transcendent power. And the point that Evie was making is, at least in the presentation of the miracles that we get in the Gospels, Jesus is uniquely emphasized as a bearer of numinous power. Now, not every miracle that he performs fits this category. There are miracles where he takes the mud, for example, puts it in the eyes of the blind man, he gradually comes to see. And that fits the mediator category more than the bearer category. But by far the largest amount, and Jesus is doing a lot of miracles in a lot of different areas, by far most of them have Jesus BMP, and he says that's unusual in the miracle tradition. It's unusual in the miracle tradition to have someone who is a bearer of numinous power. The other two categories are far more common. That's the point that he makes in his study. It's an interesting observation about the way in which miracles are presented in the Gospels and through the Gospels. Okay, that's my wrap up of kind of preliminaries, if you will. So let me stop and see if there are any questions. We're about ready for a break. And in the third hour, in our last hour, I'm actually going to present to you the rules, and then I'm going to take you through some examples.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions.